Hey, and welcome to On Science. I'm Andrew Prince, a web producer here on the Science Desk. This week, Richard Harris has the story about new regulations that may sharply limit patents on genes. And we've been keeping Richard busy. He's also got a story about how coral has been faring in the Gulf of Mexico after the oil spill. And we've got a special episode this week. I'm joined here in the studio by NPR's Christopher Joyce and Dan Charles. They're here to talk about climate change and climate policy following the midterm elections. Hi, guys.
Hi, Andrew.
Hello.
But before we talk, let's hear about one approach for controlling the Earth's climate. Last week, diplomats from more than 100 nations declared their opposition to one unusual and highly controversial method for slowing down climate change. That technique is called geoengineering. It would deploy technology on a massive scale to cool the planet. As KQED's Amy Standen reports, there are worries that such huge science experiments could lead to disaster, at least for some people. And the big question is, who gets to run those experiments?
If you want to see what geoengineering might look like, go back to 1991.
The angry giant awoke on June the 9th after a 611-year slumber.
The giant was Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines.
A mushroom cloud of steam, ash, and smoke rose 30 kilometers into the sky.
That smoke contained almost 20 million tons of sulfur dioxide. Those particles can reflect sunlight back into space. And for a while, that's exactly what happened. Temperatures around the world dropped by an average of half a degree. Now, it turns out you don't need a volcano to get the same effect. Scientists could use airplanes to inject sulfur dioxide directly into the stratosphere and bring down global temperatures. What's more, says David Keith, who directs the University of Calgary's Energy and Environmental Systems Group, it would be pretty easy to do.
It takes so little material to alter the whole planet's climate, so the costs of doing it are just absurdly cheap.
The Mount Pinatubo effect, as it's called, is just one of the ways that scientists believe they might use technology to counteract climate change, or at least its effects. Another way might be growing algae in the ocean to suck up carbon dioxide. But in order to have a real impact on climate change, the project would have to take place on a massive scale, and that could have all sorts of unintended consequences, which makes a lot of people really nervous. For instance, Diana Bronson of the ETC Group, which has been skeptical of geoengineering.
Who is liable when millions of people go hungry because the monsoon rains get canceled in East Africa?
In other words, who gets to set the temperature, or at least try to?
Where would a planetary thermostat be located?
James Fleming is a historian of science and technology at Colby College and the author of a new book called Fixing the Sky.
Would it be at Lawrence Livermore Labs? Would it be at Indonesia somewhere? Would it be in China? What if a rogue nation wanted to have their own thermostat?
On Saturday, diplomats at a meeting in Japan on the UN Convention on Biological Diversity tried to set some rules for future geoengineers. They issued what some are calling a moratorium on all geoengineering activities, at least until the science is clear and there are global regulations in place. Now, the convention does not include the United States. In fact, just hours earlier, Congressman Bart Gordon of Tennessee issued a statement encouraging research into geoengineering. But the ETC group's Bronson says the international moratorium sends a powerful message.
It would be very foolish for the Obama administration to say, we don't care what 193 countries said about this, we're going to go ahead anyways.
David Keith of the University of Calgary says he sees no real incentive at this point for any individual country to go out and geoengineer the climate, but that could change.
I do think there's a potential risk of larger countries wanting to act unilaterally when they see their interests really at stake. And we simply don't have international mechanisms to really manage that.
And manage it we must, he says, because geoengineering may turn out to be a critical tool in dealing with climate change. But there's no reason to rush into it.
I hope the debate goes a little slow because there are risks on both sides. There are real risks to aggressive quick action, and there are real risks to inaction.
Like climate change itself, the impacts of geoengineering may be global, which means it'll take global cooperation to get it right. For NPR News, I'm Amy Standen.
So, Chris, what do you make of that?
I thought that was really interesting. And in fact, I remember a few years ago, I went to a conference at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution in Massachusetts, where they had probably some of the world's top oceanographers spend almost a week talking about something called seeding the ocean with iron, which is an idea. You mix up iron slurries and you put it in the ocean. And what it does is it certain bacteria love it and they thrive. And the more of these microorganisms there are in the ocean, the more they suck up carbon out of the atmosphere, then they die. And presumably the carbon goes down and sinks to the bottom of the ocean. But almost unanimously, these scientists said, you know, hold off, folks. I mean, what you're talking about is huge, vast areas of the ocean and gigantic ecosystems that you're tweaking and messing with. And, you know, how do we measure success? How do we know that these things, organisms, are actually going to thrive the way they say they do? How will they affect other organisms? Will they displace other microorganisms? Will they actually drop to the bottom? You know, there's a hold on that, and that's pretty much the picture with most geoengineering. That said, you know, we have undertaken geoengineering. For example, when there's an oil spill, there are companies that will come out with bacteria that are tailored to eat that oil, and there are also natural bacteria that eat the oil, and they'll clean it up. And so, you know, there are examples of successful geoengineering, too.
And Dan, how about you?
Well, I mean, Chris is right. I mean, geoengineering exists because you could say the entire phenomenon of climate change that we're watching right now is a giant geoengineering thing that the human race has undertaken.
Ah, a bad one.
Agriculture, you know, on a global scale is geoengineering. And I think a lot of the talk, and there is a lot of talk these days about geoengineering, is almost, you know, an acknowledgement that all the other solutions that people have kind of come up with are really, really difficult to implement. Like cap and trade. In order to reduce emissions of carbon dioxide enough to actually limit the rise in global temperatures, the rise in average global temperatures, really astonishing changes would have to happen. In the global economy and in the energy use, particularly of developed countries. But also, it would be a drastic revision in the hopes of a lot of what are often called less developed countries.
Yeah. I mean, we should remind people cap and trade, since it's been a while. I mean, it's been off the news, the headlines for a while. Cap and trade is this top-down sort of mechanism by which you put a cap or a ceiling on a country's emissions of greenhouse gases, and then you give permits to certain industries saying, you know, you can emit this much, you can emit that much, and then they can trade and sell them off to each other depending on how well they live within their limits. But it died, and it died during a time when both the Senate and the House were run by Democrats, and many, many of whom are in favor of cap and trade. Now that the Republicans own the House of Representatives, it's even less likely that cap and trade is going to get through Congress. I think most people, from Republicans to Greenpeace, are saying cap and trade in the United States is dead.
Well, President Obama had a news conference this past week, you know, the day after the election, and basically gave up on it publicly. He said cap and trade wasn't an end. It was not the goal by itself. It was only a means to achieving this goal. And the goal was supposed to be limiting emissions of carbon dioxide. What he didn't say, though, was, okay, if not cap and trade, then what? Mm-hmm. You know, that's the big open question. Maybe the answer is no real limits at all. You know, in that case, you know, opens a whole lot of other questions about how do you adapt and so forth. But, you know, that's the big unanswered question, I think, is, okay, so what strategy do you pursue? Do you pursue any at all?
Well, one of the things that people are considering, and I've talked to environmental groups about this, they're you know, trying to revamp, or they're trying to rebuild themselves, or their point of view, their position on what to do about climate change, knowing that cap and trade isn't going to work. And a lot of what they're coming up with are piecemeal approaches, where you take a little bit of the energy cap and trade bill that failed last session. You know, Homestar, for example, is a program where you subsidize the retrofit of residential buildings. It's supposedly not so expensive. It's within people's budget, and it gives people jobs, which is really what's the item of the moment right now.
Great. Well, thanks a lot, guys, for coming in.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
The Justice Department is proposing to overturn 30 years of legal precedent by sharply limiting patents on genes. The government surprised just about everyone who follows this issue when it suggested this change in policy in a court filing last week. The U.S. Patent Office says that for the time being, it's not changing its rules, but the government's brief has thrown open an old debate about where to draw the line in patenting parts of nature. NPR's Richard Harris reports.
The gene patenting debate bubbled up again last spring over the issue of patents on genes related to breast cancer. Myriad Genetics has patented two genes, BRCA1 and BRCA2, which are the targets of a widely used test for breast and ovarian cancer. But a judge in Manhattan sided with plaintiffs who said genes like this shouldn't be patentable in the first place. The company appealed, and Myriad lawyer Richard Marsh says they asked the Justice Department to weigh in, figuring the government would defend its long-held position. The government weighed in, but largely against Myriad.
In that regard, yes, it was surprising to see that there's been this switch in thinking, I guess, by the current administration.
Marsh says even if the company loses the court case, their tests are still protected by several other patents which aren't being challenged.
As to Myriad, this case is not going to have any material impact. What we're concerned about is, you know, we're part of the biotech industry, and we believe as to the biotech industry that this will have a very, very significant impact.
Gene patents are critical for companies like Myriad. He says if Myriad hadn't had patent protection, it would never have invested $500 million to develop these tests in the first place. It would be too easy for other companies to swoop in and use that knowledge. But Bob Cook Deegan from Duke University says the issue is actually not as sweeping as all that.
Every jurisdiction in the world has decided, yes, you can patent genes when what they're doing is producing a valuable thing.
But the patents that are now under fire have their value simply because they describe the genetic sequence on the DNA. Diagnostic tests look for that sequence.
What's never really been contested in court until now is this new context of diagnostics.
And that's now a concern because soon there will be a whole new testing technology, which will allow labs to look at thousands of genes all at the same time. Will a company ever be able to develop that test if many of those genes are patented by other companies?
We don't want 15 different companies or 100 different companies testing 100 different genes. It just makes no sense. And this is the first time a judge has had to make a decision about that new context and looked at these patents in that light.
But the example that Cook Deegan raises doesn't trouble Scott Keefe at the George Washington University Law School. He says, consider your laptop computer. There are thousands of patented inventions in there. The company that makes the laptop just needs to take the time and spend the money to license those technologies from the patent holders.
While it's conceivable that patents could clog the market, could create a gridlock, and could be anti-competitive, our markets have shown over the last 30 years the exact opposite story.
Keefe argues that biotech took off in the United States, but not in Europe or Japan, precisely because the U.S. is more generous in allowing companies to get gene patents. Overturning that policy, he says, would be bad for U.S. business. But what about consumers who might benefit from the next generation of genetic tests? Myriad doesn't have to let other companies use its patented genes, but Richard Marsh at the company says, don't worry.
We clearly appreciate and agree that it would be very inappropriate to have a patent on a given technology and not let it be utilized in a fashion to benefit the public.
Myriad just wants to get its cut. Richard Harris, NPR News.
Scientists exploring the Gulf of Mexico have discovered a patch of dead and dying coral just 7 miles from the site of the blown-out BP oil well. They suspect that the coral was harmed by the spill. NPR's Richard Harris has the story.
Researchers set out on a government research vessel in October to continue a 4-year-long study of corals in the Gulf of Mexico. Chuck Fisher from Penn State University was on the trip.
For most of this cruise, what we saw were healthy coral communities at depths from 500 to 2,500 meters all over the Gulf of Mexico.
Or all under the Gulf of Mexico, because at these great depths, we're not talking about reefs teeming with colorful fish, but corals that live in the dark on the seafloor.
It was pretty clear that this didn't look like the other corals we've been looking at for the past 3 weeks.
The sea fan corals, normally bright gold or orange, were clearly in bad shape. Fisher says it was evident that many were dead or dying.
Corals that were in the process of losing tissue, that were covered with a scummy brown flocculent material, areas of recently dead skeleton.
Fisher says he and his colleagues took samples of the coral they will now analyze in order to see what caused the damage. But he strongly suspects that it has to do with the oil or maybe the chemical dispersants from the disaster.
We've never come across a community of dying corals, and to find them at that place and at this time is very strong circumstantial evidence, I think, that it's related to the spill.
The good news here is that so far, at least, it seems to be an isolated case and not a sign of trouble throughout the Gulf. Richard Harris, NPR News.
And that's it for this week's On Science podcast. You can find these stories and all of NPR science coverage on our website. That's npr.org/science. I'm Andrew Prince.